You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Hoping you're well, I'm delighted to welcome you all here in FOC, but also those of you out in the Twitter sphere. And I wanted to note this event is being webcast, and we will be taking questions later, and they can start coming in now. Use the hashtag, hashtag smartest places. So fire up your smartphones as you get a chance. Anyway, I'm Mark Muro, senior fellow here at the Metropolitan Policy Program at Brookings, and it's my privilege to kick off today's, I think, very auspicious event. I say our event and today is auspicious for several reasons. For one thing, it's always auspicious to welcome and help launch a book into the world. Given that, this is a red letter day for Antoine Van Ockmel and Fred Bakker, whose excellent new book, The Smartest Places on Earth, is just out. And if I do say so, you should all rush to pick up a copy. I think we have some out beyond the back. So on the way out, please do that. Today's auspicious also because it finds two experienced economic observers focusing not on the standard inside the beltway stuff, not on the usual spin cycles, but on what some of us think at Brookings believe are the most fundamental elements of national well-being. R&D and STEM worker-intensive advanced industries, ranging from aerospace to advanced materials to renewable energy. Regional technology clusters and local regional technology ecosystems, critical. That's part of their focus. And then cities and the collaborations that they accelerate. The fact that cities and regions themselves can become incubators of growth. Antoine and Fred have traveled the world for decades, yet have now come back to embrace the local, the granular, and the micro. I find this a welcome corrective to the often disembodied economic debates that we specialize in here in Washington. And yet none of this gets at what's really the most auspicious aspect of this morning's session, which is the fact that Antoine and Fred have actual good news to deliver. Imagine that, good news. But I think it's absolutely true, and this is a thoughtful, settled brand of good news. It's true. At a moment when many commentators have surveyed the global scene and concluded that America, or at least its industrial tier, is done, Antoine and Fred are here to flip the narrative. Where the conventional wisdom sees decline, driven by low-cost mass production in China, Antoine and Fred see reinvention being driven by specialized Rust Belt cities' increased focus on high technology. Where others have tracked the collapse of mass production of tires and steel, Antoine and Fred chronicle Akron's reemergence as a center of polymer research and Albany's growing stature in nanotechnology. And where others have seen hopelessness, Fred and Antoine have identified a reinvention playbook in which transitioning regions have turned local universities into open innovation hubs, and business civic alliances have built promising new industrial strategies in regions. In short, Antoine and Fred have traveled America and Europe and returned with an optimistic view that dozens of faded old places are becoming launch pads for the new. I find that extremely exciting. Clearly, this is a welcome counter to the scary declinism that is now dominating the presidential campaigns, for example. And indeed, this is especially noteworthy, I think, given that Antoine is a man who, while working at the World Bank in 1981, coined the term emerging markets, and in a previous book declared the onset of the emerging market century. At that time, he wasn't saying it was the beginning of the American century. It was a different century. Now he's back with a somewhat different view, as you'll see. So with that, I'd like to introduce our two esteemed authors, who, as you can see from the agenda, will also participate in a panel discussion that will be moderated by my colleague, Brookings Centennial Scholar Bruce Katz. Bruce will introduce the panel after Antoine speaks. But for now, let me introduce Antoine, who will present the book story, and then Fred Bakker, his co-author, who will sit on the panel. You'll meet him shortly. Antoine Van Ockmel is a Brookings trustee and a senior advisor at Garten Rockhoff, the public policy advisory firm. Till recently, he was the principal founder and CEO of Emerging Markets Management LLC, an investment firm specializing in emerging markets. I should note that he's also a supporter of both the Metro Program and the Office of Centennial Scholar here at Brookings. For his part, Alfred Bakker, until his recent retirement, was a prominent European journalist specializing in monetary and financial affairs, with a prominent outlet dubbed, for short, the Financial Times of Holland. He lives in the wonderful city of Amsterdam. But enough. Let's hear from Antoine Van Ockmel.
Well, thank you, Mark, for that wonderful introduction. I'm glad my wife is here so she could actually hear this. Let me start by saying that we could not have written this book without Brookings. Brookings not only helped us prepare the presentation, give us this forum, but for the past couple of years was really influential in our thinking. Brookings, and I'm talking here about Bruce, Amy, Mark, really did the path-breaking work on all of this. And it has been very good work, and we have been standing on your shoulders in making this possible. So thank you for that very much. Now, when you listen, let me take this thing here. When you listen to some of the political candidates on the left and on the right, don't you get depressed? I mean, when you listen, it sounds like this country has run out of steam on innovation, that our best times are behind us, and that all we have is problems. And as Mark already said, that's not what we found. Now, let me start by saying, if you look in the rearview mirror, things look bleak. U.S. employment, down. 7 million people, although people don't write about the fact that there are 10 million jobs now in high-tech industries, and 4 million jobs were created during this exact 4.4 million jobs in that period. And what is good is you can see that line at the end is starting to reverse. And it was not just competition from my emerging markets. It was also automation, which means that we were doing things much more productively. And, of course, it was the devastating impact of this 2008 crisis that we're coming out of. But this bad news we found is not the whole story. And this book really started when I went off to Asia, and Fred, in his travels, had a similar experience. I went to Asia meeting with many, and I've been doing this for 30 years, with many entrepreneurs, CEOs. And what do I hear? I hear them complain about American competition. Now, I nearly dropped off my chair. I hadn't heard that in 30 years. And why were they complaining? Yes, sure, labor costs were going up. Our shale gas was cheap. But the most important thing was they couldn't keep up with American innovation. And so we, after this trip, in which we visited a dozen cities all over Northern Europe and particularly the United States, and there's my daughter, we came to a very different conclusion. The American, and by the way, Northern European economies are not on the decline. No. They are, in fact, regaining competitiveness. Why? There is a new paradigm. For the last 25 years, we have been trying to compete on the basis of making things as cheap as possible. Losing battle. Certainly against China and other emerging markets. We have learned, particularly after the 2008 crisis, that it's much better to compete on making things as smart as possible. And here we're really good. We have great universities. We have this freedom of thinking that promotes thinking out of the box, that is the basis for all real innovation. We have a great legal system. And so smart innovation is beginning to replace cheap labor as the key competitive edge. Now, this rests on two pillars. The first is what we call sharing brain power. What is that? This is collaboration among university departments, but also among universities that are climbing out of their ivory towers, and small startups and old legacy businesses. And we have seen this all over the country. What does it mean? Well, in the past, things were done on a very hierarchical basis, not very efficient. Now we do it. We learned this, by the way, from what I call the whippersnappers in Silicon Valley and Cambridge. But it's not limited to that. We have learned to do things in a collegial way. It's no longer closed innovation, you know, kind of in your own thing, but open innovation. It's no longer siloed. No. Today's problems require multidisciplinary solutions. One of the trustees of Brookings taught me an important lesson. I went to see Shirley Jackson, the president of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and she said, nothing is being invented anymore within academic departments. It's all invented between academic departments. An important lesson. It's no longer top-down, it's bottom-up. It's no longer alone in your garage. No, it's done collaborative. And finally, it's no longer done in isolated research centers of corporations or the government. No, it's done in vibrant urban innovation districts. That's where young researchers like to work, as we have seen. So that's one pillar. The second pillar is we are creating a whole new branch of the economy. We had this old industrial expertise as the base. But now we have added new production methods, new materials, new discoveries. And on top of that, we combine this, we integrate that with the stuff we are really good at. Information technology, wireless information technology, and the ability to, and we didn't have that ability before, to use big data and analyze these big data to help us. And all of that is connected through a tiny, tiny little chip, the connector here, and that is the sensor. Now, that makes various things possible that never were possible before. The future is all about connecting and connectedness. Take the self-driving car. This will be a revolution in transportation. Whoop. My picture here disappeared. The self-driving car. Wearable devices. This will be incredibly important to the future of healthcare. You will wear them, you can even ingest them. The smart grid, smart farming that Fred can tell you a lot about because Holland is very good at it. All of this is now possible and wasn't possible before. This is the smart economy. This is the combination of the physical and the digital economy. Now, you might think, okay, this is nice, but we have lost all these industries. Well, think again. We now have new production methods. We have robots. Here you see Rodney Brooks, for example, of MIT with a second-generation robots. We're very good at this. Joe DeSimone from North Carolina, who invented a way to make 3D printing 1,000 times plus faster so that it can use not just in prototypes but in production. Dr. Cheng of MIT, who found a new way to make batteries. All of this will make it possible to bring back industries like socks, shirts, shoes. I talked to Phil Knight, and he said, we're already making Olympic shoes with robots. So this is one thing. The other really interesting thing we found is that this innovation that we talked about, this collaborative innovation, is no longer limited to places like Silicon Valley and Cambridge. It has spread all around the country, to be exact, to more than 30 brain belts, we call them, in the United States, to more than 15 brain belts in Europe. So let me illustrate that with one example. All of you have heard of Akron. But would you have thought this was one of the smartest places on Earth? Maybe not. Well, what did we find? You had the four old tire companies gone practically overnight with the loss of a lot of jobs. A life-threatening challenge. And by the way, all of what we see is always based on a life-threatening challenge. Then you got the second element that you find everywhere, a connector. This one, in this case, the president of the university, Luis Proenza, who got people together, who got people to collaborate because they had no other choice. And what stayed in Akron, what didn't disappear, was the world-class polymer research that has given us things like contact lenses that change color when you have diabetes, tires that can drive under all kinds of road conditions and are needed for these self-driving cars. And I can give you hundreds more inventions like that that they did there. But they now have 1,000 little polymer companies that have more people working for them than the four old tire companies. That's what I mean by changes. And so you have a life-threatening situation, universities. It's always university-centric. Each of these places, each of these rust belts that are becoming brain belts, have universities with world-class research. They're dealing with the problems of our century. They're no longer simple problems. They're complex, expensive challenges that require multidisciplinary approaches. There's an openness forced by reality and necessity to share brain power. They have a connector, and they have an infrastructure that attracts and retains talent. And by the way, that infrastructure includes affordable housing. That's why people move from, let's say, Silicon Valley to other places like Pittsburgh or Akron or whatever. So, and finally, of course, you need access to capital. These are the key characteristics. Now, we have Albany, New York. Did you know that in Albany, New York, just outside of the nanotechnology complex, and under the leadership of Alain Caloyeros, a former Christian militia fighter from Lebanon, by the way, who became a great physicist, they are at the forefront of semiconductor research. Next door, you have Global Foundries that has thousands of employees working in one of the most modern plants in the world. Here you see a machine. I was in that clean room with the white head on. And that little machine there costs $1 billion. It's the most modern machine to make semiconductors in Albany, New York. Not in Sinchu Park or Korea, in Albany, New York. The Research Triangle, Bob Gaiolos, you'll see him in a minute, is here. Let me tell you a story on the sidelines of the Research Park. Well, you had the old Lucky Strike factory. No more cigarettes being made there. Now it's an incubator and a very lively place. Portland, Oregon. Here you see the old waterfront. Phil Knight gave $500 million, and that brought together the university, OHSU, with Intel that was already there. And together they could do things they couldn't do alone. And now you have basically the university brought back to from the mountain to the city with tramways and, to make my Dutch heart warm, bicycles. So Eindhoven in Holland, from light bulbs to the world's smartest city, as it was called. Here you see the old Philips. And now you have the technical university that became really an open innovation platform. We'll talk about that later. So 30 places, over 30 places from all over the world, two-thirds of them former Rust Belts. And in Europe, 15 of them as well. And we describe in detail 10 of those in our book. These Rust Belt cities are building on forgotten strength. Now, we couldn't be at Brookings without some policy recommendations, right? Otherwise, so let's go through them. I'll just talk about two, but there are a whole bunch more. The first is this. We have a 21st century economy. I've become convinced we are measuring it with 20th century statistics. We have to stop doing this. We are mismeasuring our productivity. You know, Google Map or Google Search is not in the GDP statistics. We have to find a better way to do this. Second point is terribly important. Why is there all this anger in this country? There's a job mismatch. A number of people cannot find jobs after they lose them in this new world. We have to develop programs of training for jobs that are based, I think, on a really good model, which is the German work study model. It is a great model. We could do it, and we can do it, and I think we probably will. We have to reward sharing of brain power through the grants that we give. We have to support and build innovation districts. We have to build political support for more basic research. The United States still does two-thirds of the basic research in the world, but we have to keep doing it, otherwise we lose out. And finally, venture capitalists should have the leeway not to make profits the next day, because then they invest in social media, but in a more leeway to invest for the longer term. So, in conclusion, as you can see, Fred and I are optimistic. We think that the United States, Northern Europe, has a very good future. Innovation is not dead. Competitiveness is not dead. In fact, we are regaining it. Maybe the best way to sum it up is, if you look outside, is it's no longer winter in America. Spring is coming back. Thank you. Oh, yeah.
So I'm Bruce Katz from Brookings. It is an absolute... How does that work? I'm just playing around here. Absolute pleasure to moderate this panel. It is an absolute pleasure in this season of despair to be optimistic about the future of our country and the future of many similarly situated cities in Europe. You know, Fred and Antoine have done... all of us, I think, a great service. I mean, this is almost like a de Tocqueville book, right? It takes two Dutchmen, though Antoine's been here for a while, to come to America and remind us what we have, right? So very, very helpful. We have two other people on this panel that I think I'll just give a brief introduction. They are two of the top economic development thinkers and practitioners in the United States. Rebecca Bagley is Vice Chancellor for Economic Partnerships at the University of Pittsburgh. She took several of us on a tour of UPitt and UPMC last week. If you want to feel optimistic about America, go on a tour with Rebecca at UPitt. Prior to that, she worked for Nortec in Northeast Ohio. She's worked in Pennsylvania state government. I may have a question about that. And then Bob Giolis is head of the Research Triangle Park, really the iconic science park in the United States. Prior to that, he worked with Clemson, North Carolina State. So these folks are really at the cutting edge. But I want to start with Fred. So about 4 years ago, Mark and I took a trip to the Netherlands. So this is a tough job, right? Took a trip to the Netherlands. And you took us to Eindhoven. I frankly had never heard of Eindhoven before, neither had Mark. And we had a remarkable day where we saw a turnaround story, a city that had Philips Electronics at the heart of that city, had lost tens of thousands of jobs to Asia. But within about 15 years, this is a city that is basically voted one of the most innovative cities in the world. What happened?
I shall give the short version, but it's a long story. But Eindhoven originally was built around two companies, the one you mentioned, Philips, and DAF Trucks. That's now a subsidiary of Packer, the Portland-based company. And they came in big troubles in the mid-1990s. Philips announced that they would ship their manufacturing to low-cost countries and that it would have 30,000 job losses. And in the same year, DAF Trucks went broke. So that was a horrible scenario for Eindhoven, but not only for Eindhoven, for the Netherlands as well, because Philips is a phenomenon in Holland. We are proud of that company. We are critical, but we are proud. Dutchmen are always critical, but they are also proud. And so that was a trauma for that region. But there were people who stood up quietly, and they thought of a very ambitious plan, vision more, to make from that region, Eindhoven, a high-tech hotspot on a specific item that's building high-tech machinery. And but how do you do it? And Antoine already told you that technology is too complex to do it on your own. So people knew that you had to collaborate. And but in sharing brain power, as we call it, and in you need collegial teams. But there was a problem at that time, because the companies and the university and the city of Eindhoven and its nearby communities were all siloed, closed, vertically, hierarchically organized. And if you want to build that those multidisciplinary teams, you have to break them open. And in Eindhoven, there was not one connector, but there were three connectors early this century. And to start with one, that was the CEO of Philips. And he took the courageous step to open up the siloed, closed research lab, a lab that is similar to or was similar to the Bell Labs. And he had much resistance from his own employees and from people around Philips, but he opened it up, and he did something more. He invested a lot of money in building an open high-tech campus, and he put his own research team on that campus, opened up facilities for startups, laboratories, clean rooms, and invited foreign companies to put part of their research on the campus as well. And what do you see now? 6,000 researchers from all over the world working on that campus. That's the first connector. The second connector was the president of the technical university. And he and his colleagues went out to the companies and interviewed them. What are the skills that our students need to get those jobs that you are creating? And so with the information he got from those enterprises, he built colloquia that were able to break through those silos that were also inside those universities. And the third step was taken by the mayor of Eindhoven, because it was not Eindhoven alone anymore, but there were 21 other communities where companies like FI, like NXP, like ASML, like Philips Healthcare, were doing their research and manufacturing. So instead of fighting each other, he invited them to and came up with a proposal to start a foundation with all those 22 communities. And they decided that the mayor of Eindhoven would be the president of that foundation, and they gave it a brilliant name, Brainport. And that said it all. And that was what happened in a relatively short period of time. And there is one other thing that is remarkable for the Eindhoven region, what Antoine and I didn't see in all the other places, that was the change that took place in the supply chain. Mm-hmm. From all those little companies that were in that region. And that was the initiative of ASML, early this century, to ask their suppliers, and ASML is a semiconductor machinery maker that is the world leading now, after they have beaten companies like Nikon and Canon. But they asked their suppliers, who were earlier this century still delivering components on strict prescription from ASML, and they asked those companies to put their R&D in those components, right, so that they changed the supply chain into a value chain. And that is very, very unique. Mm-hmm. But let me...
You're a journalist, so...
let me change your... When Mark and you and I were in Eindhoven, at the end of the day, we drove back to airport, Schiphol Airport.
Yeah.
And can you... Because this is the story of a Dutchman about the Dutch situation, and that's suspicious. But can you tell me what you remember of that feeling when you left the city and drove with me to the airport?
Well, I'll tell you two things. On the way into Eindhoven, I thought you were nuts. this is
you're not the only one.
This is a city that I don't. How many people in the room have heard of Eindhoven? Oh my God! Okay. Well, that's because you've read the book. But on the way into the city, Fred's describing to me, Amsterdam is the airport, Rotterdam is the seaport. This is the brain port, and I'm going, right. Okay, that's a great brand, but. By the end of the day, I have to say what was the biggest takeaway was we went to see the mayor, we went to see the head of the business chamber, we went to see the top investor, we went to see the technical institute, we went to see the high-tech campus. And everyone was almost completing each other's sentences. And that was it was almost scary. Have you ever seen Stepford Wives? It was almost like a Stepford Wife kind of moment where everyone was just saying literally the same thing, a unified narrative, a unified vision. Whereas when we go to many parts of the United States, you'll go see one of these actors, mm-hmm. and then they'll tell you, oh, when you see so-and-so, half of what they're saying isn't right. So this was what the biggest surprise to me was what you now call sharing brain power, but in almost a frightening way, how much there was a consistency of focus and vision. And by the way, the high-tech campus in Eindhoven that we now know from Antoine and Fred's book in 2014 had 50% of the patents in Netherlands. This is a relatively small geography, but the synergy and the open innovation is really working. So that's what my main takeaway was. By the end of the day, you had convinced me. Antoine, you coined the term emerging markets. You must be receiving a lot of kind of emails, phone calls from some of your former colleagues. Go, what happened? Describe the transformation.
What I always say is, I quote Pat Moynihan, who said, we're all entitled to our own opinions. We're not entitled to our own facts. So when I look back at the emerging market century, I still think that we live in the emerging market century, because the center of gravity of the global economy continues to go toward the emerging markets. It's no longer the American, but the emerging consumer that is king. That stayed the same. I had a third point in my book, and that was competitiveness is shifting to emerging markets. That's where I've changed my mind, because I think actually competitiveness, as I told you earlier, is shifting back. Yeah, some people don't like that, but, you know, facts are the facts. I'm an analyst, like you are an analyst, and you call it as you see it.
Fred, and this is another question in terms of the acceptance of this perspective, both in the Netherlands and in other parts of Europe. You know, you're an observer of the American political scene, our reality TV show. To what extent do you feel that either local policymakers, national policymakers, broader sort of networks of civic and university and business leaders accept this premise, either in the Netherlands or in some other sister countries?
It depends on the parties you look at. The established parties understand it, and they also see the challenges.
Right.
Because our whole social system is siloed as well. And one of the main conclusions for me is that the situation we describe is a bottom-up horizontal development. And all the policies of the past 30, 40 years are vertically. So, and you see in Eindhoven region that is not working anymore. So they are in talks with people in our capital city to change that politically. That's one thing. That's one, and that's a positive thing. So that's a question of strength.
Mm-hmm.
But you see that there is the same in Europe as here in the United States, that globalization is felt by certain groups of people who find that scary development, and they feel threatened. And there are politicians who put their finger on it, try to picture a future in which we can go back, mm-hmm. or close mm-hmm. our borders and become we are in a process of uniting in the EU, and people think of the old days that we have a sovereign government, we had the Kilder and not the euro, that we had the Deutschmark and the French franc and not the euro, and people are lost. There is not yet a new identity, and they are looking for that new identity, and a growing group is thinking that turning back to the old days is the solution. And I completely disagree, but
Bruce, I want to add something to that, because you know, I live in Washington. And you hear everybody bash Washington. And we describe this process as really a process that is bottom-up. People are not waiting for Washington anymore. But, and this is a little-known secret, the environment that makes all of this possible, all of this collaboration possible, was created by Washington. 1980, the Bayh-Dole Act said you can take research that is funded by the federal government, and universities and researchers can use this and profit from it. Well, they did. And that is what made Silicon Valley possible. Where did Google come from? Originally from a $700,000 National Science Foundation grant. You know, how did we get to the moon? By an earlier form of collaboration. So the government has a part of that. And then who is the most innovative venture capitalist in the United States? It's DARPA. Why do we have a self-driving car? Because DARPA did a competition that allowed Stanford to participate, and then quickly Google bought the whole team. So here you see this collaboration. The collaboration is often by buying and stealing and then collaborating. But places like DARPA and InQtel are actually important. And this act was of absolutely critical importance.
I want to come back to that. I want to bring Rebecca and Bob into this conversation, because if you listen to Antoine and Fred and the words they're using, connections, connectors, connectedness, brain sharing, in many respects, the institutions you work at now are almost the antithesis of this, right? I mean, Research Triangle Park is like a group of isolated companies out in 7,000 acres of pine forest, right, that were sort of carved out.
Pine trees and possums.
And University of Pittsburgh and UPMC and Carnegie Mellon, I mean, it's an old sort of academic tradition that Antoine really described as breaking down, of the disciplines staying within the disciplines. So is this shift to open innovation and collaborate, is this happening in your institutions, and how is it manifesting itself? Maybe start with Rebecca.
So yes, is the short answer. It is happening. I mean, I think it's interesting because the connected networks that we've been talking about, they really happened back in the industrial time of Pittsburgh, you know, when steel was large. It was just that top down, you know, that you talked about. So there was 15 guys or 25 guys who got in a room and decided what the critical things for the community were. They were in competition, but when it came to Pittsburgh, it was very important for them to collaborate and sort of lay that out. I mean, I think one of the big changes is the complexity of the economies, which is a good thing, you know, has created the need to really look at connectedness and look at opportunities very, very differently. One of the things that Pittsburgh did with the crash of steel and when the economy basically overnight fell apart was they really had the foresight to bring together the university leadership, the government, the industry all together instead of just looking to industry or looking to one sector basically to solve it. And that was through the Allegheny Conference at the time. And so they really reinvented the economy through that time. Now I think we're in an accelerated rate of transformation in Pittsburgh, and actually it's a moment in time where our connectors, our sort of networks are shifting very dramatically, really over the last year and a half, where we're seeing an influx of young people. We're seeing Google has the most people outside of Silicon Valley located in Pittsburgh. Uber moved their autonomous vehicle work there. So, I mean, there just was an explosion of companies moving in, of neighborhoods pushing out. So places you could not go into 10 years ago, you know, are the dynamic technology hubs. And so I think that's where, you know, Antoine, with your slide about, you know, what it used to be like and what it is, I think we had broken down some of those barriers. I really think we're in this accelerated, transformation stage of those networks being different. And I really think the universities have a critical role in that. I mean, there's $1.2 billion in research between Carnegie Mellon and Pitt going on in Pittsburgh. We can't keep that inside the institution. It really needs to benefit not only Pittsburgh, but I think the other evolution we're going through is we are globally connected. I mean, we have global influence, we have global connections, and we really need to both take advantage of that for our region, but also to be able to share that knowledge with the globe.
How about from your perspective?
Well, I mean, like Rebecca said about her region, it was a very deliberate decision in North Carolina in the 1950s, a very deliberate public policy decision to develop a Research Triangle Park. And it was described at the time as very audacious, because not only were we 49th out of the 50 states, but we were we didn't have any comparison. Stanford Research Park was only a couple years old when we opened RTP. But there was a deliberate and conscious sort of agreement that was structured where the government would fund infrastructure and education. The private sector would lead the foundation. We've always operated as a private not-for-profit with a public mission to serve education, create meaningful work, and lift up the people of North Carolina. That's our job. And then there were the universities who were basically instructed to, you know, educate a workforce. And what we're seeing today, and I think this is where the creative energy, and I think it really is more energetic than anything else, it is a shifting away from that top-down or more directed approach to one that is wildly more organic. Mm-hmm. And it is hard for people to sort of let go of that in some ways. And I think we're beginning to see that in RTP itself. We're taking a 7,000-acre site. I like to remind people that's about half the size of the island of Manhattan. We don't have a Starbucks anywhere in RTP. It was never, you know, think about that. We may be the only 7,000-acre site in the world. But we were not designed to be that way. And so there's sort of this interesting idea of, well, do you know, how much do we master plan it and site plan it, and how structured can it become? In many ways, the most exciting things we're doing is opening it up for wild interpretation and letting the actors create their own play. Mm-hmm. And that is becoming very exciting. It's very innovative in terms of changing the old model. It's very disruptive. But it's also creating the great opportunity for amazing convergence. And in a park like RTP that isn't only a biopark, I mean, we're not a biopark or an ag life park or a net. We've got all those technologies. 60% of the companies in RTP have 20 employees or less. So people only think of the big. So you have this great big pot of things going on. And now when you start connecting them, the convergence opportunities are huge. So it really is about letting go of that older structure and letting it be much more organic.
So just let's follow up on that point. And you know, Antoine and Fred should come in, because it seems like as we move towards this open innovation space, which requires collaboration, which requires people to really engage seamlessly with each other, we're sort of reinforcing and validating cities in a way, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, proximity, density, vibrancy, authenticity. You know, when I was in Pittsburgh last week, I could see the whole part of the Oakland neighborhood and beyond really beginning to change from like Fortress UPitt to Fortress Carnegie Mellon to Fortress UPMC to something that really looks like a city. You've got a much bigger challenge out, you know, in the park, right?
Yeah.
So how do you think about placemaking as it reinforces innovation?
Well, so, yeah, we're sort of the hole in the donut, because we've got a great city in Raleigh. We've got a great city of Durham. We've got sort of a village of Chapel Hill. But we've got this dynamic growing.
We're going to get a tweet from Chapel Hill.
I know. I love Chapel Hill. They're proud of their village in Chapel Hill. Yeah. But we are this hole in the donut. And so we have this dynamic growing region, you know, all around us. So I was just at MIT last week at the future of suburbia.
Right.
And the whole conversation is, yeah, we love what's happening in our cities. I mean, remember, the cities were dead 30, 40 years ago, right? The reason why RTP was successful in the 1950s and 60s was everybody was leaving the cities. They didn't want to be a part of that. Mm-hmm. So, but we can't let the cities die. I mean, the suburbs now have to be reinvented. We have to rethink the way they work. And so I think that there are three things that are going on. I mean, I think one, yes, urbanity matters in that it creates physical places that are highly collaborative and fun and engaging and a lot of social activity. But, you know, if you look at Silicon Valley outside of San Francisco, you have a lot of suburbs, but there you have tremendous amount of culture around risk-taking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wild risk-taking. It's okay to fail and start over.
Right.
One of my favorite places I visited in the last few years was the Imagineering Studios of Walt Disney, which are still in the same studios he picked out in 1956. They're highly innovative in terms of the products they deliver, but what drives them is not urbanity, it's brand. The people who work for Disney would have worked for Disney Corporation. It wouldn't have mattered where it was. So you really have to think about in your own space, what is it that is going that you can embrace? Is it your brand? Is it your urbanity? Is it your culture? So whether it's suburban or urban, ultimately you have to embrace what's true and authentic and genuine to you and really celebrate that. And I think the placemaking is so important, but it's not important devoid of the people. Respond to what the people want. Give them a chance to shape it and own it, and you will be amazed what will happen. And that's something we can do in America and in Western Europe that's not as easy in a lot of other cultures right. in the world. And that's where I think our great optimism lies
right.
in our future, in our economy, that sense of freedom and the sense of exploration and that dynamic nature that is, you know, part capitalism and just part democracy, I think are things that can't be duplicated in some places of the world that have strong economies but aren't necessarily the most innovative places.
And Bruce, we have done it before. What was Bell Lab?
Right.
Bell Lab was this fantastic, you know, meshing and really friction of brain power. And, you know, how did we get the jet engine? How did we get to the moon? It's always through this collaboration. We sometimes forgot about collaboration. Mm-hmm. And I think if we make that a focus, as you are very much doing now, I think it will make a real change. It is making a real change.
Yeah, it is.
I think one of the things, too, that came up last week, actually, in Pittsburgh was relationships and transactions. And this was kind of, we were thinking about, that there's, you know, there's those relationships that you get through the synergy and through the work, and a lot of things are built on relationships, but there's also a lot of things you can do transactionally now, right?
Right.
Where the human, you know, I mean, a silly example that somebody gave at the meeting was, you know, if I needed a prescription quick, I used to call the doctor friend that I know. Now I go on my UPMC and actually email any doctor, and they'll write me the prescription, assuming it's, you know, within my medical plan. So, you know, I just thought it was, you know, so that he didn't have to use that relationship anymore, right? So I also think that an overlay of all this is not necessarily top down, but what are the systems that you're putting over this to enable not only the regional or the placemaking, but the global connectivity? And so I think we need to not only think about these collaborative bump into spaces, but then how do you create the systems for that to scale?
Great. That's a great point. By the way, if you all visit UPMC, it's not for the faint of heart. I saw a mouse having open heart surgery. I'm still recovering. I was going to ask a question because, you know, Bob brought it up. I'll just make a statement, because if you go back to your state government basically being in the vanguard of creating one of the most innovative spaces in the world today, and then you look at your state government today, which seems to be...
Thanks for bringing that up.
No, but I think we all know what's happening in North Carolina. If not, just look at the New York Times
right.
this morning. Perhaps we don't need to dwell on that. I would like one last question before opening it up to the audience. Does all this innovation and collaboration and openness work for a broader segment of our citizenry, from employment and jobs, particularly in the core cities?
Right.
Because if you go to most of these innovation hubs in the United States and you walk five blocks,
right.
you're in an area of high poverty, high deprivation. So are those connections being made? Do we have the right tools? Do we have the right systems?
Right.
How do we think about that?
Well, I was just going to say, I think there's a whole series of exciting policy opportunities
right.
around that. Because I think that, in fact, the hardest thing for universities and for cities and traditional people doing economic development is, how do you measure that?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because it's so organic and so dynamic. And most of these institutions only get rewarded based upon a more specific set of data points. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I think institutions like universities need and others is, how do you begin to evaluate whether or not you're seeing success out of that? That's a sort of a whole set of policy questions, I think. I think we've also looked at economic development in the past as really sort of event-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And we've structured our governors and others to sort of celebrate the singular event, you know, the 400 new jobs, the 500 new jobs. The truth is, the whole economy we live in is far more dynamic than that today. We're going to see companies grow and lose employment, and it doesn't necessarily say anything about the place you live.
Mm-hmm.
And economic development is less about specific events. It's much more about a longer-term process. And so how you react to those new pieces and the policies that you need both in cities and in universities and in government, to really take advantage of that process-oriented approach.
Bruce, clearly the answer to your question is not yet.
Right, yeah. Right.
That's right.
I mean, clearly a lot of people feel left behind. Mm-hmm. And they have good reason to feel left behind, because there is this, we are no longer in an era of job losses. That's the past. Mm-hmm. No, that's the rearview mirror. Because just as we lost 7 million jobs, we created 4.4 million jobs. There are 10 million jobs now in this high-tech sector. Brookings Research has shown these are not just jobs for PhDs and college graduates, although, by the way, that employment has grown. No, half of those jobs, if I remember the numbers, I think, Mark, you did that research, are for people with post-secondary skill. The problem is those who have less than post-secondary skills. I mean, we need to activate, and in Durham you're doing that, for example, the community colleges to go back to what they were founded for, right. Not yeah. to get you into college, if you can, fine, but to work together with corporations, to work together with the government. And finally, there is going to be, for those left behind, no, in the end, this is not an economic issue. In the end, this requires a political solution. Do we as a country have the guts and the sense of solidarity to do that? And that is, at the moment, very much an open question.
I would just add that, I think in economic development, we really embraced rising tide, lifts all boats for many, many years. And I think over the last year or so, too, there's been a real recognition, and I think it's still evolving and changing, that that's actually not working. I mean, it certainly lifted some boats, but it did not lift all boats. Right. So dedicated strategies into disconnected communities where you can connect to the new economy. And a lot of the work that I've done, we're leveraging the work that already happens. So at the University of Pittsburgh, I'll use the current example. We have a social work program. We have pharmacy programs, dental programs. They are all working in these communities. Connecting that, leveraging it, and bringing opportunities for next economy where appropriate, I think that's an incredible way as a university that we can tie that in. So I think working with the people that are already working in those neighborhoods and figuring out how workforce development, what are the needs, educating parents so that they're, counseling their children in a way that leads towards opportunities in this next economy. So I think those are some of the things that we've been working on. But I think there is definitely a recognition that rising tide does not necessarily lift all boats and that you need dedicated strategies to move that.
Right.
To add something to remarks of Antoine about solidarity and the way it is organized, I think that's a big difference between the United States and Europe. Mm-hmm. That in Europe, in this point, local communities, companies have set up programs, work-study programs, and that's more part of our culture and our structure. And that doesn't mean that people are not feeling left out. That's the same in Europe as well. So we have to put a lot of effort in it, because that is a very important middle class group that is needed, and that must not be left to its own.
It just strikes me, building on and also what Antoine said, is, as we look at these innovation hubs in the United States and Europe, increasingly Latin America, Asia, they're not just platforms for economic, technological, product innovation or process innovation. What we see happening in many of these places is really social innovation.
Absolutely.
I mean, the community colleges are co-locating, fab labs are opening pre-K opportunities for people in the community are being manifested. I mean, this is it's much more substantial social efforts going on than I think is well understood. And we're at the sort of early end of that. I think we're going to open it up. We're going to start over here and just state your name and then provide a question, not a statement. And then there are some folks on Twitter sphere who may want to send some of their thoughts as well. Start over here. Oh, about starting in the middle there. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you, Rick Rybeck, and thank you very much. Learned a lot, and it's great panel. Question. As I understand it, the collapse of our manufacturing industry and urban flight from our cities really caused land values to collapse. And in part, this created an opportunity for startups that are risk-averse and don't have cash. You know, a lot of cheap rent know, was probably pretty key to all this happening. To what extent, now that the innovation economy is taking off, to what extent is there the danger that land speculators will move in, jack up rents, and sort of kill the goose that lays the golden egg?
It's an interesting challenge.
Yeah.
I mean, we have, you know, rising housing costs in Pittsburgh, and I do think it's, somebody said earlier, I think, that, you know, affordable housing is going to be a key element to making sure that it is sustainable. We still have a lot of opportunity to work in to certain neighborhoods, housing situations that I think could be both very affordable and could help with some of the blight that's going on in the neighborhoods. So we still have, I mean, it's a lot of the neighborhoods have been developed, but there's still a lot more developed that needs to be happened. So that's, of course, a very high-class problem to have, you know, for a city that's been in decline. And I think we're not quite, at least in Pittsburgh, at the point where we're going to have that problem really, really soon, although we are seeing in the most coveted neighborhoods very high, you know, the price is going up.
So I think it's one of the most exciting things, in fact, in this, that the suburbs have to offer, is that, so if you look in RTP, we purchased, the foundation purchased 100 acres about 2 years ago, and on that was about 500,000 square feet of old 1980s buildings. The first thought was, well, let's tear them all down. And but my wife and I, and you know, give the credit to my wife, she's always got the best ideas. She said, well, why don't you take one of them? Because one of the criticisms about the park is you're not able to get young people back in. Why don't you open up the space and let's see what happens? So we opened the space. We called it the Frontier. We beckoned all the new pioneers back, all the dreamers, the believers, the creators. We made the whole first floor of the space completely open. Now, there's nothing precious about it. I mean, I will say to people in the real estate business, the day of marble, ferns, and fountains is done. Keep it flexible. Keep it affordable. So we opened it up. I mean, we did some fun things in the lobby and that kind of stuff. The space is completely full. We've had over 30,000 people use it over the last year. It's completely open to anybody who comes in the door. You don't have membership or anything. So what happens is we have teachers mixing with artists, meeting with startups. We've got the Bunker, which is the Vet Entrepreneurs Group located in there. We've created a shared newsroom cooperative for journalists and bloggers and freelancers. And it has become one of the hottest co-working spaces. So I think it doesn't take anything away from our urban, but let's be honest, we've got all these buildings in the suburbs. We can't tear them all down. We have to think of recycling them. Now, the question is, how do we do that but also connect to all the things that everybody wants in terms of services? Because most of these are located in islands. But I think it's a fascinating challenge, and I think it's where an opportunity for our suburbs can play a role.
This is great. I think transportation comes into the
transportation, always transportation.
Yeah, I must say, coming from a very small country like Holland, I'm always impressed by how vast the spaces are. You have a long way to go, first of all. And then, as a businessman, I learned, first you fix what needs to be fixed. Then worry about what can go wrong 10 years from now. But it is a worry.
But, you know, I was University City in Philly. Philly's 138 square miles. University City's 1 square mile. You know, Midtown Detroit and downtown Detroit, 7 square miles.
Yeah.
The city's 138 square miles. Exactly. We have so much to do because people and jobs just flew out of these cities. So the day of marbles, ferns, and fountains are done. No more Trump Towers? Okay, that was a nonpartisan. Over here.
Oh, no.
Thank you very much. I'm Paula Stern, and congratulations to the authors. The gig economy, didn't hear it once. And I think about the job mismatch, which you talked about. How do we fill in the blanks besides affordable housing, for those who are in the gig economy and move around. And I also would love it if you would address places like Portland, Maine, that doesn't have a large university.
Great food, though.
Exactly, and very attractive from all the other demographics that you've described here today, and doing a lot of the same things. They better hurry up unless you have some other answer, and that's what I'm asking.
Answer on the gig.
Well, on Portland, first of all, Phil Knight gave first 100, then $500 million. Portland, Oregon,
But I asked about Maine. Portland,
Maine. I don't know enough about Portland, Maine. You know, you're not going to turn every little town into a brain belt, you know. there's lots of work to be done in lots of different places. But to know that we have gone from basically two spots where things were happening to already 30 spots where things are happening, that's already a very big change. And so this will grow. If you see Imelt of GE talking about Batesville, Mississippi, because the Mississippi State University has such great research on also new materials, then you see that this will spread and spread. That's what I hope and believe.
I agree. Look, in North Carolina, we have a rural economy that's struggling tremendously. There is no way that the success of the Research Triangle region in Charlotte can carry the whole state. So when we meet and talk with a lot of these communities, one of the things we talk about is, one, leveraging your community colleges. They're tremendous. Yeah. Number two, our public university system has an obligation to serve the state, connect to them. It doesn't have to be physical. You have the virtual world. You can connect. The universities would love to do more connections. Take advantage of that. Number three, they come to see me and they say, we want to create an RTP. I said, no, you don't. That's 50 years old. What you really have to do is go back to leveraging your own assets. What is it that's wonderful about your community? Sadly, I would say, too many of our communities over the last 20 years have fallen to the Walmart and suburb sort of approach, where they're starting to look like every place else. What they almost have to do is kind of go take a look back. What defined the character of your location and embrace that? Not every entrepreneur in the world wants to live downtown. Some would love to live in small towns that have bicycles and great places to eat and are connected to the world. And I think Brookings and other policy places can help provide tools to small communities, a set of things to strive for. What are the measures they could reach for? Many of them need those kinds of metrics and tools and resources. But we're not going to get to everybody, but we can make a difference for some.
You know, and this does have a college in it, but one of the examples of that leveraging, you know, kind of the small town assets, I moved from Oberlin, Ohio to Pittsburgh a year ago. And Oberlin actually has done a really interesting job. You know, they don't have a research institution. Of course, they have a strong university. But of really leveraging their reputation of sustainability, of, you know, sort of liberal town into entrepreneurial co-working spaces, sustainable focus. And so that might be a model to look at as you are passionate about Portland.
Yeah, Maine. I mean, I think Portland, Maine is one of the great creative entrepreneurial communities in the United States.
Right.
It has a minor problem. It does not have a state government.
Yeah.
Literally. There is no state government in the state of Maine.
Right.
Question over here. Yeah.
So, hi, I'm Ari Gerstmann. It's a great panel. When I think about the geographic features of archetypal Rust Belt cities in America, they're inland, they have sufficiently high elevation, access to fresh water.
Right.
To what extent do you think Rust Belt cities can leverage their resilience to climate change to compete now and in the future with the coast and the Sun Belt?
So I think it's a huge opportunity. Hearkening to my Cleveland experience, we started the Cleveland Water Alliance. You know, to really leverage some of the assets there. There's a pact for the Great Lakes states with the governors on climate change and climate issues and really aligning. I mean, it's definitely a challenging issue because you're still a huge manufacturing region. There's still a lot of the old industry. You really need to figure out how to bring policy together that can both embrace that, because you can't get rid of, I mean, that's the bread and butter of still of a lot of those regions, while you can take advantage, as you're saying, of these assets like fresh water and other assets that we have that I do think are going to be. And, you know, the other thing is, and, you know, we talked about this a lot when we lived near Cleveland, I think that these cities are cool. I mean, they just have that. The hipsters, you know, started sort of that movement in of that industrial look, you know, and feel, and then the renovated spaces. Like, some of these newer towns just can never, you know, capture that. So just as a quick side note.
And the RTP, we're obviously not, you know, we're nowhere near the ocean, and we've got some lakes, but, you know, we don't have a port there. But if you look at the park, one of the things our hipster community is very interested in, you know, is organic food and natural growth. And I think as we look at climate change, how do we take better advantage of the land that we have and use that efficiently? So within our 7,000-acre research park, we're asking ourselves, all that green grass we've been mowing, can we turn those into garden spaces? Mm-hmm. Can we make that part of the living experience? Can the food that goes into our restaurants come out of the park? You know, so there's a whole series of things. But this gets back to, as well, a lot of regulatory issues that don't necessarily give communities the ability to be that flexible.
Right.
And I think that's where we can do some work as well locally to make it possible for us to be more creative and imaginative within our urban and suburban spaces.
Yeah. So, Rebecca, we should have called the subtitle of the book not From Rust Belt to the Hot Spots of Innovation, but to the Cool Spots of Innovation.
Yeah.
There you go.
Missed opportunity.
I've got some Twitter questions here.
This is a question from Laura Putra, who's a staff writer at Industry Week. Will the new jobs in these cities approach the number of jobs lost to offshoring and automation?
You want to take that?
I think, again, Brookings has done more research on this, but... will it? Yes. Has it? No. I mean, this takes time. I mean, we did a lot of outsourcing. Yeah. We did a lot of damage. And to repair damage, you don't do overnight. Right. But as I said, you know, we have an economy now that is 10 million of high-tech jobs in advanced industries, et cetera. And that's a lot of jobs. And, you know, when we went around, I mean, there are lots of anecdotal examples. In Portland, Oregon, for example, you go to a place that was one of these renovated places. Used to be a factory where they made ropes for, you know, the boats. And there were about 350 people working there. Gone, you know, empty. You know, drug use in the lobby. Now, it's a spiffy new building, incubator. There's lots of lawyers, small companies, everybody sharing brain power. And there are now 400 people working in that building. That's the kind of thing that you will see, but it takes time.
Mm-hmm. Just to build on that question, let's talk about the elephant in the room, China, right? I mean, is this changing our relationship with China? Rebecca, you talked to me last night about this very interesting partnership that UPIT has with Tsinghua. Right. And how that's beginning to really evolve. So are we now talking about a new collaborative relationship with Chinese companies and Chinese industries?
I think we can have an incredibly cooperative relationship. And, you know, again, we have a deep history of the University of Pittsburgh in 2011, helped Tsinghua University, which is largely thought of as the MIT of China, actually start their medical school. So we have at any one time 20 to 40 Tsinghua medical students on our campus, working with our research labs and our researchers. And so that depth of relationship created the opportunity to now have a technology commercialization and transfer discussion. So we signed an MOU with just a few months ago with Tsinghua and with Tusk Park, which is their related venture park, and with our tech transfer office to be able to really connect opportunities that need, because remember, a lot of our work is in life sciences, so we need deployment markets in China. Talk about where the consumers are, right? And the regulatory environment's slightly different. And then also, though, there's Chinese companies, entrepreneurs that are entering the U.S. market. So there's a lot of synergy between the two. And we're talking about really leveraging that relationship even more to really create this global biohealth connection. So I think that those relationships that you can look for that can be creative, that can have your connector role, but thought about it not just in your community, but across the globe. Right. Can really help us leverage.
Bruce, just as we said in the book, don't count out the old economies.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We're not saying in the book, don't count out China.
Right.
I mean,
right.
This is a really important country for the future and will remain a really important country for the future. And what I found interesting was that when we published our book, or when we had the book ready, it went to the Frankfurt Book Fair, and the publisher called me very excitedly and said, you know, I've never seen this. On the first day the book was bought for translation, I said, by whom? I hope it would be the Dutch. No, the Chinese. They got it. They have been the manufacturing center of the world. Now they're just a manufacturing center of the world. Mm-hmm. They get this, they know deep down in their heart that they're very, very good. Mm-hmm. I mean, excellent, much better than we are at thinking inside the box. They now see that there's a threat from thinking outside the box. Mm. And they have a bit of a glass ceiling here. So there are things. And believe me, I've seen this transformation in China. They'll catch on fast.
Yeah.
Last question. There was right over here. Okay. Sorry, Twitter sphere.
Thank you very much for a great presentation. I'm Elliot Hurwitz, a former World Bank and intelligence community and State Department person. You did, I think, mention driverless cars.
Mm-hmm.
And in the current issue of The Economist magazine, there's an article on China's progress in pioneering driverless cars. And China is also very good in biotechnology.
Mm-hmm.
So what does this kind of competition offer to Rust Belt centers?
The sense of competition shifts all the time. Now, I read that article. And sure, they're beginning to develop that expertise. But Google has been at it for the last, 10 years or so. So, 10 years gives you a certain head start. So when it comes to really smart products, I think the United States and to some extent various European places have an enormous head start because of this sharing of brain power. What we sometimes forget is that political revolutions are noisy and bloody. Economic revolutions kind of creep up on you. And this is what's happening now. What we're seeing is an economic revolution. We just don't get it yet. Just think of how you've learned to live with your smartphone.
Mm-hmm.
How you now don't go to the library to look something up in a book. No, you do it right in your pocket. It's just happened, and you haven't even noticed it. It's a revolution.
I will tell you, working in the Research Triangle Park, you have people say to you all the time, well, what do you think about what they're doing in China? Or what do you think about what they're doing in Boston? Or what do you think about what they're doing in Silicon Valley? And
we get, what do you think?
Yeah, what about RTP? Look, Teddy Roosevelt said it best. Comparison is the thief of joy. You can sit around and obsess about that. Just get on with it. Just get on with doing stuff. Make a difference. Work with people. Make things happen. It'll I'm a great optimist and a great, and I just believe that have faith in your people, in your effort, make your investments, and just get on with it, and things will happen.
So I want to end on an affirmative note, and I want to bring Rebecca into this because Rebecca was part of this network of SSTI, which stands for
State Science and Technology Institute.
Brilliant. And they came up with this fictional federal policy or federal program or set of federal initiatives that probably everyone in this room would support and build directly out of this book. And then they pulled this fictional program. And what were the poll numbers? They were like
incredible.
Off the chart.
It was called ISTEP, was the name of the program, Innovation, Science, Technology for Economic Prosperity. And so it was basically university research, the commercial engine that could get those things out, and then the intermediary organizations, these connectors that we've been talking about, and pulled a lot of different elements of that. In battleground states, it was 92% approval rating, 87% across the whole. And then the interesting thing is we said, would you pay for it? And the most avant-garde one we tried was gasoline tax. So people would pay 54% in battleground states said they would pay a gasoline tax to be able to fund increased research and development, increased commercialization portals. And so it's a really interesting, it was done by both Democratic and Republican polling agencies and, you know, the whole polling methodology. So I think it's an incredible opportunity to be able to leverage the SSTI, and we have an Innovation Advocacy Council now that we've formed, with that polling data into all of these conversations. And I'll also end, too, with the book. I mean, I think we've been talking about these types of things for a long time, and I think the book gives a lot of credibility in the way that Fred and Antoine wrote it to be able to bring back to our city governments, to our city leaders, and really be able to talk about what needs to happen as we accelerate this transformation.
The era of cheap is over. The yes. era of smart has begun. Thank you, Antoine and Fred. Thank you, the panel.
Right here. Yeah, sure. Rebecca. Yes. Take your mic so I know.